Welcome to the Perimenopausal Mamas Podcast for hormonal mamas who want to reclaim their own natural state of health to thrive and raise healthy kids. I'm Dr. Lisa Weeks, naturopathic doctor in Toronto, Canada. I'm a perimenopausal mama to my two-year-old toddler named Stuart.
And I'm Dr. Tony Reed. I'm a naturopathic doctor, birth doula, and hypnobirthing educator in Calgary, Alberta. And I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little girl, Frankie.
Welcome this week. I am so excited to have a guest for our podcast. I'm going to be sharing with you a colleague that I am so thankful to have in my life that is a great support to the patients that I see. I am speaking today with Kimberly Mueller. She is a registered psychologist in the province of Alberta in Canada. She has a Bachelor of Science in Psychology with a concentration in Behavioral Neuroscience and a Master's of Science in Health Psychology with a concentration in Nutrition. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Perimenopausal Mamas Podcast, Kim.
Thanks, Tony. It's super fun to be here, and the feeling is mutual in being your colleague.
Oh, it's wonderful. You know, I really think of health and my patients having a health team to really support them, and it's just wonderful to have you as a potential member for my patients' health team as well. I think it's really key to look at the mind side of our health and thinking about mental health as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We cannot separate them out. I think that they're so intricately intertwined that you can't just address the physical and you can't just address the mental. So it's a great sort of integrative approach I take as well.
For sure. Before we jump into our conversation, I am going to take a moment to share my super mom moment of the week. Just this past weekend, we were at the Calgary Folk Music Festival. It's near and dear to my heart. I've been volunteering with my fiance for years. That's where we met. And we took our daughter, Frankie. It was her second Folk Fest. And I totally felt like a super mom most of the time there. I was totally prepared. I had blankets. I had warm clothes. I had bottles. I had toys. I had her hat. I even had noise protection for her ears. Unfortunately, she didn't want to keep that on, but I just felt like we rocked it. We had our wagon. We had everything together, and I just felt like a super mom most of the time. That being said, then that also leads into my mom mess up moment for the week, where we were at the playground at the Princess Island Park in downtown Calgary. It's an amazing playground for kids of all ages, and she loves going there. We were at the playground. I looked away briefly. We had some friends visiting, so I looked away to just see where they were at. I looked back at Frankie. She stumbled on the stairs. I missed catching her. She fell down the stairs. I felt like that was the opposite of being a super mom at that moment. And that was definitely my mom mess up of the weekend. And I also want to talk about an amazing mama must have. I'm definitely not a big fan of plastic water bottles. Even the BPA-free water bottles that have other plasticizers in them, like BPS, can mess up your hormones. They are endocrine disruptors. Yes, they are handy. Yes, you can easily pick them up at Costco or wherever. And that's where a great alternative is to have an indestructible stainless steel water bottle. I have one for myself, and now I have one for Frankie. It's fantastic because they're lightweight. Unlike, glass water bottles are great, but they can be a little heavy. Having one, you can throw in your bag, fill up with water as you need. you can throw it around, the kids can throw it around. It's an amazing thing to have. How about you, Kim? Do you have something that you can't live without and you think that, that other perimenopausal mamas should have?
That is a tough one. A water bottle is a great one. And in fact, when I was listening to you, I used to have a glass, well, I've had two glass water bottles. And the other piece that they're heavy is they actually do break, even the ones with the nice, you know, little cover type thing. And so I've broken two of, actually my son broke one of them. He was being a great little kid and filling it up for me at the airport pre-flight. And he dropped it and he was devastated. And foolishly, I went and bought another one, and now I no longer do that. So stainless steel. Yes, I agree. That's a good idea.
Awesome.
Mom must have. I don't know. I think the only thing that comes to mind without thinking about it is, now that we're in the summer months and the weather is great, is having just a listing of free family fun activities in my area, because it's like every weekend we treat as a mini vacation, even though we're not staying overnight anywhere, but we pack a picnic and we go explore somewhere new. And so for my husband and I, we have a great resource in our city called Calgary's Child, which is just a like a newspaper that's put out every quarter, I believe. And it has tons of fun ideas, and we'll just pull that out and look something up and go. And it's really been, it's been a positive thing. So yeah, if your community has anything like that, or if there's groups that have a ton of listings on that, I feel like for us at this season of the year, that's a must have.
Yeah. Awesome. Oh, I completely agree. Calgary's Child magazine is fantastic. And then, I mean, even in people in other communities, you know, reach out to friends on Facebook. You know, there's there's different moms groups up there, and lots of other moms will have ideas if you don't know exactly what's going on in your community as well. Yeah.
Great point.
Awesome. So Kim, what would be the best parenting advice you've ever been given?
I think that is a hard question. The interesting thing is my parents never gave us any parenting advice, which I do appreciate. Which sometimes I wonder, why wouldn't we pass down the wisdom, you know, from the generation? But yeah, it's kind of like we have to learn it on our own, I guess. But I did hear something once, and I found myself repeating it many times to myself and to my clients that I see in my psychology practice, which is, and it seems odd that I would believe this, but it really resonates with me, particularly when a parent is getting really anxious about what their child is doing or not doing, or grades or dance or hockey or, you know, all these things, is that, or even just how they are in public, you know, because we somehow feel they're an extension of us and they're part of our identity. What I try to remind myself and my clients is that they are not ours. They are with us for a period of time, and then they go out into the universe. And it kind of makes us realize that, yes, they are with us right now, but we do not have to think that we have so much control over them, or so much of our identity needs to be tied up in them. It's just like, allow them to be. You know what I mean? They're with us for a while. It's like anything in our lives, you know, they don't have to define us. And of course, we love them with all of our heart and we want the best for them, but we need to loosen our sort of attachment, I think, our egoic attachment in some ways to who they are, how they're acting, what they're saying, and just kind of allow that to be. And I think that can lessen some of the stress that we feel about who our child is becoming. And therefore, that kind of gets transferred down to them, that they have permission to be loved and accepted for exactly who they are, without conditions and expectations. So yeah, that one has really stuck with me. That would probably be the first thing that comes to my mind.
I think that is so powerful and so important. And I really as a new parent, it almost seems to me that that's a bit of a shift from previous generations, where parents have really kind of took on like that idea of like, that child is mine, almost kind of that idea of like property, or or that, or again, that kind of extension where that little being is, you know, completely their own, and to kind of let them grow and make their mistakes and be themselves and not feel like, yes, that is a reflection of who I am or have these judgments.
And I think that's such a good point from the sort of intergenerational transfer of that mentality, because I would imagine that I know myself and perhaps you as well, Tony, have felt that burden in some way of we had to be a particular type of person or fit into a particular mold and probably even regress to that when we go back to our childhood homes or, you know what I mean? And it was like, it wasn't okay to be different or to not fit that. And I think we as adults, we're in that process of healing from perhaps a little bit of what you're describing, which is this property or this idea of, you know, whatever it may have been, you know, you become a dentist and you stay a dentist the rest of your life or, you know, whatever those sort of, and there's a generational shift in that. So I hope that we can kind of, with our generation, step into the a little more fluidity and looseness around that, you know, rigid belief system that we have may have been raised in.
For sure. And that's where, I mean, I'm sure between us and even, you know, the women who are listening to this, everyone has had a different experience of what their relationship to their parents is like, and even experiences in childhood that really kind of form who we are. And that can really, especially if you haven't really looked at that closely or done any work or therapy, that can really color how we parent and kind of who we are with our kids and even our partners. You know, how do we start to kind of look at, you know, shifting that of not having that, that hold or that filter, that of our past and bringing our past into how we parent and I don't know in terms of how you work with your patients so that they can really be the best parent they can be regardless of what their parents did to them or what kind of other situations they've had in the past.
That's a great question. I think that the first thing I would say is that I don't know where we got this idea or notion that we deserve perfect parents. You know, I don't think anybody has that nor ever will. And so it's like, it's fine, you know, if we weren't brought up in that sort of idyllic, romanticized version of reality. But there is a ton of value, particularly as you move into adulthood and parenthood, regardless of whether or not you have children, I would say this is true. You begin to see your parents for who they are. And when we're children, they're all that we know. Whether it was positive or negative, for us, that was our only version of reality. And so we thought that's just how it was. But as we progress into adulthood and our eyes are open to experiences, we can begin to see the inevitable faults in our own parents and in their parenting choices. And I think for when you're first in that transition period, it's hard to reconcile that because it's like, wow, this, you know, this omnipresent being has faults and I can see things or some of my tendencies of their faults are starting to come out in me. And it really is a process of increased self-awareness and being willing to be like radically self-honest about that with yourself. You know, if my mother yelled a lot, I'll probably be yelling a lot with my children. If my mom was a very disagreeable personality type and my father was a very agreeable personality type, I am likely going to think that that's okay, you know, that one member should more often than not succumb to the other's, you know, desires or hopes or what kind of furniture they want to buy, you know what I mean? And so it's really being able to break down how our family of origin is influencing us. And there's good and bad. But I think it takes a lot of willingness to be super honest with self to see how some of the faults in our parents or in their mistakes might be manifesting in our own parenting. And then it takes a lot of intentionality, because think about it, it's 20, 30, 40 years of conditioning on our nervous system of that's how we react. That's how we respond, you know, when X, Y, and Z happens. And so it doesn't happen overnight. So give yourself permission to make mistakes and learn from them. But I think it is a really valuable lesson as we, you know, become parents, just to look back at our own family of origin. And then, of course, our partner's family of origin. What was like in that house growing up? And how did that impact how you view which furniture to buy, or, you know, how to discipline the children and that kind of thing. And so and people maybe don't realize that can take a lot of conversations and that it's worth, you know, bringing those things out into the open so that you guys can, you know, do the best that you can with your own family.
For sure. Yeah. Especially when you're talking about relationship and not just, you know, being a mom, but being a parent, especially if you do have a partner, you know, looking at what, you know, what your partner brings into it and how you work together to parent, with, you know, two different sets of history, two different sets of baggage, all of that. And how
you absolutely work together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even, you know, kind of when you're talking about, you know, really looking at, being honest with yourself and letting yourself make mistakes. I mean, I just immediately go to that. That idea of something that we've kind of talked briefly about before of mom guilt, and even how social media comes into play with what we project out to other people in terms of happiness and being perfect. And having high expectations, you know, and I wonder, you know, is mom guilt just inevitable, or, you know, is there something that, you know, is there a process that we can really go through to minimize any guilt that we feel or high expectations that we have for ourselves?
It's a juicy topic, and it's one I thought a lot about, and we could do a whole podcast on it.
Do a podcast about it.
right. But I think that because I have struggled with it myself, I work full time. I'm only in the office 4 days a week, but the fifth day I am working on my notes and I'm not with my children on that day. And I have a 5 and 8-year-old son, I guess. And so I struggle with it, and I have done a lot of thinking on it and helped other women who've struggled with it. And one thing that I like you said, is it inevitable? I think the answer might be yes, at some level. It's inevitable, but it's manageable. The reason it's inevitable is I think that we are knocking on some very primitive parts of our brain when we're experiencing mom guilt. We're sort of evolutionarily wired to want to protect our young. And so, you know, the very idea to think that we're not going to be doing that because we're going to go and seek out resources, which might be a more strong primitive need for the male brain. Now, I understand that this is, you know, making generalizations, but it is what it is. I think that we experience a dissonance or not feeling right at some level, because that part of our brain is, you know, still there. We're still operating on that software system, even though we're in, you know, the 21st century. And the reality is, I think, I don't know what it is, maybe 70% of women work. I don't actually know the actual statistic. But, you know, evolution hasn't caught up to that reality. So we have to find a way to kind of reconcile this. And I think that it has to be remembered as well from an evolutionary perspective that we were tribes. And so the entire village raised the child. You know, we weren't trying to do it alone and do all the resourcing. And so that's the way that I look at it. When I have my daycare home provider or my children are at summer camp today, it's the tribe helping me raise the young, you know, and the reality is they're probably doing a better job today than I would if I were with them. And that's amazing. And they're learning so many social skills, and the data does not skew one way or the other of children who are at home with mom all the time versus in daycare all the time as being better or worse. So we can kind of put that to rest. But what we need to do when it surfaces, because it will rear its ugly head, is go through a bit of a process and just kind of pause with it and go, okay, guilt is coming up. What might be happening in my life right now? Am I working a lot of extra hours? Am I, when I am with them, being really short with them because I'm exhausted from working the extra hours? And then we just have to look, is there something that can give? What would help me feel better right now? And maybe that's just looking at the calendar and going like, I have all of Saturday and planning a fun activity. And so when the feelings come up, we need to investigate them, because emotions are trying to signal something to us. They're trying to reach out to us and say, hey, listen to me. So we have to be curious about it. But then we also have to realize this is the reality of the situation. They're getting good care. I love my job. It makes me a better mom. All of these good things. And just, it's going to take many, many rounds of this and many iterations of this sort of processing. You know, I had my children in day home from the time they were 1 year old, and now they're 8 and 5, and it still comes up. I have to say, one really practical thing that has helped me is if my spidey mom sense ever felt that the care that they were in when I was at work, something was off about it, I didn't feel super comfortable about it, I wish I would have tuned into that earlier, because it was usually right. And I was just avoiding the hassle, to be honest, of like looking for something else. But once I feel that they're in a good place while I'm at work, the mom guilt really does get turned down, the volume. And so the practical piece is, you know, there's nothing's going to be perfect, and you can always find, oh, she does it this way, or whomever is looking after the children. But if your mom intuition is saying, I don't know, I need to think about this, I would honor that and listen to that, because that's probably going to help you lessen the mom guilt if you need to make a change, or if you just need to ask questions to make sure whatever you are worried about is fine, if that makes sense.
That's really interesting, that idea of like, okay, is this guilt really, does it come from a place of, you know, your spidey sense going off and your gut telling you something? Or is it, again, this kind of primitive brain, you know, just age old part of, you know, what women have done and what motherhood has been, and to kind of look at both of those sides to see, is this a useful feeling or not?
I love the way you put that. That's really, really good. Yeah, to kind of go through that process. And it's helpful if you have someone to talk it out with, whether it's your partner or a friend, girlfriend, therapist, yeah, whoever it may be, to just talk that out, because we really do get to, you know, because we can get lost in our heads. So it's good to have somebody, right, to talk that through with.
Yeah, well, and that's a really good piece. Absolutely, we can get lost in our heads. I mean, I really think, you know, as human beings, our brains are, and our what our minds do is so interesting. And the thoughts that we can create and the feelings that we can create, can be really out there. And then how that comes to play in our lives and in our relationships, and how it can interfere with, our relationship with our kids, and how we do mother, and even our relationships with our partners, and interfering with intimacy that way, you know, we're just such complex beings, and it can get really messy. And I don't know, is there, do you think that there's a point where, it makes sense for a mom or woman to seek out psychological counseling, or should we just all be in therapy?
Oh, well, you know, you're going to get a biased answer from me as a practicing psychologist. But I don't know. I mean, I think everybody could benefit. I mean, that's the biased answer that I, yeah, and I do believe that as well, because I think, you know, I often say to my clients, awareness is about 70% of the intervention. You know what I mean? It's being aware of what emotion is coming up, being able to put a label on that and going like, okay, sadness. Okay, what's underneath the sadness? Fear. Afraid of what? You know what I mean? And so it's like, once they've done that, they're already feeling better. They don't even necessarily have to, you know, make a lifestyle change or leave a relationship or whatever it may be. So I really do think that, you know, working with a therapist can help you look at things through a new lens that you may not have considered. And it doesn't have, you don't have to have a diagnosis or a problem to seek out somebody. It's like we train our physical health. We brush our teeth. We do all these things. Well, what are we doing for our mental training? You know what I mean? And yeah, for our, not only our, you know, mental agility and be able to cognitively focus and do a great job in terms of task-oriented things that might be useful at work, but, you know, our emotional barometer, like how are we tuning into that? And I mean, it's, that's kind of what a therapist does. It helps us bring to the surface that which we might be suppressing and repressing, or we don't even know how to deal with. So yeah, I think every mom can benefit. And also, like you had said before, our minds can be a dangerous place. And our imagination can take us places that, like, you know, it's just, we can create these stories and these narratives, and if we maybe work with a therapist, or, you know, a really great friend can also work if you don't have the financial means, they can challenge those narratives that we are telling ourselves. And that's a lot of the work that I do with a cognitive behavioral therapy approach, which is cognitive, is learning how to challenge your distorted thoughts. Some of the examples are like mind reading, which means you think you know what the other person is thinking, and you've created this whole story, and she hates me, and she doesn't like me, and she ignored me. And really, she wasn't even thinking that for a second. But that's one example of a cognitive distortion. Or catastrophizing, right? Which is, if I go here, I'm probably going to like not find a parking spot, and then I'm going to be late, and then this, and this. And it's like, whoa, you haven't even done it, but you've created this, you know, anxiety about approaching a new situation. What else? Yeah, those are some examples of the cognitive distortions that people, we look to try to teach them to challenge, because they're not serving them. It's like, wait a second, can we find an exception to that? And the behavioral piece is also very important, because my mantra around that is mood follows action, not action follows mood.
So
what that means is, do the action and then assess your mood. Because when I'm working with people who have depression or anxiety, they're probably never going to have that perfect mood to go out and go for the walk, or to, you know, face dropping off the clothes at the bin in a new parking lot that they've never been to before, because they have so much anxiety and uncertainty around it. So we have to realize that we do the action first, and then we assess our mood, because it's going to likely be elevated, because our internal audience is going to be super proud that we did something. And I know it's hard. It's super hard. And I have so much compassion for it when anybody is struggling and feeling symptoms of depression or anxiety, that it's like, I just can't get out and do it. But the concern is, by not doing it, we reinforce that there was something to be afraid of. And so we never start to build that confidence. So I don't know how I got on this tangent, but that's the approach of CBT. And that's another thing that a therapist can kind of help nudge a person towards if they're struggling.
For sure. Well, I think that's such a crucial way that you framed it as well, Kim. You know, if you're stuck in a certain mood and with the idea that I can't do this thing because I'm not feeling up to it, then chances are, you know, how are you going to be able to get out of that mood in order to do that thing?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and there's a piece where you'd like, yes, talking to friends is great, and it's you know, it's really important to have, again, that social network and those the people that you can lean on and vent to, and and talk to, whether it's, again, friends, partner, family, that kind of thing. But those people aren't necessarily super objective when it comes to your life and the stuff that you're going through. And again, even just kind of the thoughts that you have. So they may not be the best people to really help pick you out of that stuck place to really challenge you gently with compassion to really get you moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. What we would call it in our ethics code as psychologists, we can't have what we call multiple relationships, which is I can't be your therapist and be your friend, or, you know, any iteration of that, because there's bias involved. So it is hard for a friend to be completely objective, particularly if they think they need to say something that you may not want to hear, then how does that make affect the friendship and that kind of thing. So that's where there is value in being like, you know what? I'm just going to meet with a therapist. This person has no skin in the game.
Yeah.
She or he wants the best for me. And, you know, that, like you said, that social tribe is there for something else, you know, to just unconditionally support you. But this is probably something, you know, that you really want to get an objective piece of advice on. So that's where a therapist can be super helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially for those women, and I'm speaking from experience of, you know, the kind of women who do have a bit of people pleasing, and especially when talking to friends, don't want to necessarily bring up the stuff that they think they're going to be judged for. So when you're going to, you know, a psychologist who's a complete stranger, who, you know, isn't in your life, you don't have to see them every day, you can say what's really there for you. You could say what's on your mind and even, like, you know, dig a bit deeper to stuff that you don't really feel great about that's going through your head. But it doesn't really matter because, you know, I don't necessarily, it's not going to matter what you care about me because you're the psychologist.
Yeah. That's such a great point. And I think that you just hit on something super important because, again, evolutionarily, we're wired to want to have status amongst our tribe because status ensured survival. You know, if we were well-liked and accepted, we were going to have food and shelter. And so your tribe are your friends and your family, and you don't want to necessarily expose things that might lose your status. You know, with really close friends, you can, and you can be vulnerable, and that's a beautiful experience. But yeah, I understand what you're saying where, you know, some things you'd rather just keep to yourself and share with, you know, a professional. And that's exactly why psychologists exist.
Yeah. You know, I think this conversation is so important in terms of really talking about mental health, and that's why I'm so glad that we're talking today to just really kind of look at, okay, you know, how do these things come up in the minds of moms, especially because, I mean, you know, research has shown that our brains as mothers actually changed physically. To really, again, gain that piece of again, looking out for our kids and being a little bit more, you know, aware and on alert, to protect them, to have that security and safety around us. And there's a piece where that can kind of snowball, you know, especially if a woman, even, you know, before having kids, had a tendency for anxiety or even some post-traumatic stress in their lives. Or even if they don't, you know, anxiety can definitely rear its ugly head postpartum or, you know, becoming a mom. You know, and I know that one of the things I love about your practice is you have a few different tools to be able to deal with that. Can you talk a little bit more about how you approach anxiety, whether it's postpartum or otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, anxiety is probably the number one most common symptom that I see with my patients. And then there's various subsets of that. But it's very common. And so when I started my practice, I was just doing traditional talk therapy in the form of counseling, like you would imagine that a psychologist does. And that's awesome. And it's really effective and it's wonderful. However, I noticed with a certain set of clients, they knew more than me in some instances, or they knew that they were being irrational, or they knew that they should get out and ride the bike, or they knew, you know, that their childhood was impacting them. But what I could see was there was like a subconscious sort of stuckness. And what I realized that just talking about it wasn't going to be enough for them. And so I began to investigate alternatives, particularly from the school of what do we know helps with trauma? Because a lot of times people have some level of trauma in their past. It can be big T trauma, little T trauma. It could just be, all our emotional needs weren't met by our parents. And I would call that some level of trauma. And so I began to go on this quest to see what does the literature support in terms of efficacious interventions to help, because then they have the trauma, but now they have anxiety, and they don't maybe put the two together that it could have been because of that. They've developed anxiety because there's uncertainty and they have to be hypervigilant because they don't know what's going to come next. And they always had to think of the worst case scenario because they kind of were wired to have to do that from whatever might have happened in their background. And so I found something called neurofeedback. Neural feedback is basically training of the brain. And what happens in the brain is we can get stuck in certain patterns of firing. We have electrical activity at all the time firing around in our brain, releasing the neurotransmitters and the serotonin and the dopamine, all those great things, which Tony knows more about than me. But
not necessarily. I think you know a lot about it.
What we know is that just talking about things doesn't necessarily remove them. And so neurofeedback helps at the subconscious level to reorganize the brain so that it is no longer firing or stuck in patterns that are causing anxiety or causing insomnia or keeping the trauma stuck in their body. And so neurofeedback is super, super easy. Basically, clients come in, we hook their brain up with some sensors, and they listen to music. And during the session, every once in a while, they hear a little bit of a scratch. And that scratch is notifying their brain that they were about to veer off to the side of the road. So it's a little bit like the rumble strip. And it allows you to go, oh, well, I didn't realize I was doing that. Let me go back to the center. Or maybe you wanted to do that, so you proceed. But it's over and over real time. It's training of the brain, essentially. Because you see, the brain doesn't want to have to exert a lot of energy. And it takes a lot of energy to be anxious or not sleepy or depressed or ADHD or whatever it is. And so when we can give the brain information about what it has just done, it's going to soak it up and reorganize itself to be more efficient and more resilient. And so I do both counseling and neurofeedback, and it really depends on the client. Some people just come in and they know they want neurofeedback. Some people we've started in counseling and we've decided together that I think some neuro would really help give you that boost or help release some that you may be holding on to get to where you want to go. So it's a nice balance, and it's nice to have a couple of tools depending on which client is sitting in the chair that day.
I think that's fantastic. And I love the fact that you have the neurofeedback, because yes, I completely agree with you that, I mean, talk therapy is great and it can get you to a certain place. And oftentimes there's more. So I really love that idea of kind of delving into the subconscious without necessarily having to do anything about it. You know, it's a really kind of passive type thing where you just sit there and the magic of the computer does what it does to help to kind of reorganize the brain that way.
Yeah, it's incredibly passive, and almost, you know, people are like, really? That can do something? It's like, it's so powerful. I mean, I can't help but anecdotally, you know, recall so many expressions of, you know, changes and shifts for people that I like to say it's a little bit like the World Wide Web, in that it's super easy to use, but behind the scenes, it's incredibly complex in how it's organized. So that's kind of how I describe the neurofeedback experience.
For sure. And, you know, and I've definitely seen patients of mine where with the neurofeedback and other support, we've been able to get them to discontinue anti-anxiety medication because they don't need it anymore. And even for myself, you know, I used some neurofeedback when I was pregnant and had some anxiety come up and have some sleep issues. And I found it was fantastic, so that I could really stay asleep so that, you know, the mind racing didn't wake me up and keep me up at night too. Do you find that a lot with your patients as well?
Oh, 100%. I would say across the board, improved sleep quality is reported by most. And I mean, we know, you know, that that's so incredibly important to health. And it's not necessarily, like for me personally, I can speak to my training in that I actually thought I noticed I was sleeping less, but I think the quality of it improved because I was more rested, less fatigued, more energetic than ever before. And so I think that the quality of my sleep really improved and it can really help with that. And I love training you when you were pregnant. And I love training women who are pregnant because I call it a 2-for-1. And then the baby feels your sympathetic nervous system calming down. It's just a beautiful experience.
It is an awesome experience. And it's such a fantastic tool to have. I'm really thankful that you went through that process of discovering that, I need a little bit more for my clients and we need to kind of push things a little bit more. That's awesome. Any last words that you want to share with the women who are out there listening, in terms of emotional resilience and being the best moms they can be?
I say, if you're listening to this podcast, you're already doing an amazing job. And the fact that you're thinking about how you are as a parent or as a human being, you're already amazing. And that we're all doing the best that we can. And you are stronger than you think. And you need to see every tantrum or every challenge with your teenager or whatever may arise as an opportunity. It's not a reflection that you've been a bad mom or that you have a bad child. It's going, let me meet this child where they're at and see how we can move through it together. We don't want to shut it down. We don't want to say, don't cry, stop, calm down. That doesn't help. You know what I mean? We want to like really teach the resilience to our children by meeting them exactly where they're at and just recognizing that we're doing the best they can. They're doing the best they can. It's not because they're a bad kid or a bad child. There's often an underlying reason. And if we can like get rid of our guilt or our worry about what does this mean for our child in the future, or what have I done wrong as a parent? It's like, just take a deep breath. You know, it's one day at a time, and we're all just doing the best that we can. And I think all of us as women need to support one another as best we can. Don't get into the compare and despair game on social media. I mean, come on, people. That's so boring. You know what I mean? Like, let's just be real and celebrate our successes and learn from the things that were like, yeah, that wasn't so good. Awesome. What am I going to do next time better? And move on. That's all you can ask of yourself as you're navigating parenthood.
Kim, I think I might have to listen to this podcast over and over just to remind myself of all of those things you just said, because those are such powerful messages to again, remember as moms. Awesome.
Oh, that's awesome.
So now are you available for consultation online as well as in person?
Yeah, actually I do. I do phone or Skype counseling sessions, and you just have to shoot me an email or go to my website, which is psychologycalgary.com.
Sure.
Yeah, it's psychologycalgary, all one word, .com. And then if the neurofeedback piqued your interest, obviously I'm not in your city. You could find somebody in your location by going to the neurooptimal.com website, and you just put in your postal code and you'll probably find an amazing practitioner wherever you live.
Perfect. We'll have to share that in the show notes. So again, you're available for contact on your website, psychologycalgary.com. Again, Kim, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate all of your wisdom, and most likely we're going to have to talk again some more, and so I can get some more wisdom from you.
Well, it was a true joy, Tony, and I love talking about this because I really believe that us women can be so hard on ourselves, but we don't need to be. And so this is such a fun topic, so I'd love to come back sometime.
Awesome. Yay. Thanks so much. Thanks for joining us. All you perimenopausal mamas out there, have a great week, and we'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.